Hey everyone, just a heads up that this episode features some descriptions of torture.
I'm the accused witch, and you are the Waymaster.
Waymaster, yeah, and I ask you to take your place on the wooden platform so I can see if you are weightless or not.
Okay, let's do it. Am I a witch or not?
Hundreds of years ago, tens of thousands of people, mostly women, were murdered for imagined crimes.
He got it into his head that this wasn't just weather. No, this wasn't a storm. This was an attempt on his life and the work of witches.
It shows the roots of misogyny in modern society, and it's because 85% or thereabouts of those accused were women.
But the witch hunt isn't over.
We're still living in the era of the witch hunts, really. It kind of doesn't matter which century you're in, you might end up going down the same path.
People are being killed. People are being buried alive. People are being poisoned.
So how has the witch hunt transformed?
It's a witch hunt. It's just a continuation of a witch hunt. They want to silence you.
And how are we still connected to this chapter of history that many of us thought was closed?
History is usually written by the victors, not the victims. And it all depends on whose eyes you see the story through and who is telling the tale. Who?
Welcome to season two of Don't Drink the Milk. I'm Rachel Stewart. For those of you who are new here, this is the podcast where we unravel the curious and sometimes dark backstories of familiar things and find out what they reveal about our world today. Like the witch hunt. I feel like we hear those words all the time in the news. It's become a kind of throwaway phrase. But there's a twisted history behind it. And the less we know about its dark past, the harder it is to control its consequences in the present. We'll get to that. But first, I'm dying to know if our producer Charlie is a witch. So, Charlie, what's the verdict?
Well, let me set the scene again. So, I get up on this big wooden platform. It's a giant old scale, hundreds of years old.
I normally don't weigh myself like this, but...
Now your position is off the floor, so you have a weight which is in accordance with how you look like. You are not able to fly in a broomstick.
Couldn't possibly.
You're far too heavy to fly in a broomstick, and therefore never can be a witch, because witches fly on broomsticks.
There you have it. Not a witch.
Huh.
So, believe it or not, back in the 16th century, one of the most surefire ways to prove that you were not a witch was just to be weighed.
But then couldn't anybody just weigh themselves and be like, look, I'm heavier than a feather, I'm not a witch?
No, not really. You needed official certification from a weighhouse. And although you'd think that would be easy enough, sometimes the weighing was rigged.
Mm.
But there was this one weighhouse in the Netherlands which gained a reputation for being fair and honest, for weighing people properly. It even got this royal blessing from Charles V. So basically, if you got a certificate from this place with your weight on it, it was your proof that you weren't a witch.
And that's where you went.
That's where I went. These days, it's a museum directed by Isa van der Vee. She showed me around and she explained to me what it was like for people who travelled there from all over Europe, desperate to clear their names.
The person who came into the weighhouse had to be undressed and was searched by the midwife. The hair should be loose because they could put extra weight in or on their bodies. And they had to put on a white linen shirt and had to kneel down on the scales to be weighed.
And so do you think that a lot of people who did come here thought, I might be a witch?
Yes. Once they were weighed and got a certificate, people were very, very, very happy and relieved.
Because if you were accused of witchcraft and you couldn't clear your name, you faced persecution, torture, even murder. And about 500 years ago, that's exactly what happened to many thousands of people. Now, you've probably heard of the Salem witch trials, which happened in Massachusetts in the US in the late 1600s. They've been immortalized in modern pop culture. Think Arthur Miller's 1950s play, The Crucible.
Did you see Goody Proctor's spirit?
Never! Never! Stop it!
Or 90s movies like Hocus Pocus.
Twist the bones and bend the back.
Here to decapitate Malika Mystica.
Turn him of his baby
fat. Here to decapitate Malika Mystica.
Give him fur black as black, just
like this.
But Salem wasn't actually the first witch trial in the US. And it was also relatively small compared to the witch hunting that took off in Europe about 100 years earlier. From the late 1400s, France, Italy, Switzerland, Germany, Austria, and Scandinavia, they were all sites of intense witch panics and institutionalised hunting. Tens of thousands of accused witches, mostly women, were tried, tortured, and executed. Around 40% of those executions took place in Germany alone. But there's another country that caught our eye in the gruesome statistics. A country that, in relation to its small population, killed five times as many accused witches as the European average. A country which was home to some of the most infamous witch trials of the period. And where the whispers of the past are getting louder.
Today, on International Women's Day, as First Minister, on behalf of the Scottish Government, I am choosing to acknowledge that egregious historic injustice and extend a formal posthumous apology to all those accused, convicted, vilified or executed under the Witchcraft Act 1563.
Scotland, 2022. Nicola Sturgeon, the First Minister at the time, is dedicating her International Women's Day speech to people accused of witchcraft hundreds of years ago. Because this small northern European nation seems to have noticed something important that the rest of us might have missed. To figure out what exactly, we're going on a trip through time and over the North Sea.
Are you ready? Good. And vow, Tam so an uncorsished, warlocks and witches in a dance. Nay cotillon brent new from France, but hornpipes, jigs, strathspeys and reels put life and metal in their heels.
We've made it to the Scottish capital, Edinburgh. It's cold, it's windy, and kind of damp. We're following Juniper the Witch around the city. She's got this black cape on, a pointy black hat, and she's carrying a broomstick. She's definitely giving witch. But what she has to tell us takes us far beyond this well-worn stereotype. Don't worry. Just now, we heard her reciting some poetry.
So that was Old Scots, and it's an excerpt from Tam O'Shanter, very famous poet by Scotland's national poet. Does anybody know who that is?
Someone did know. And, of course, it was our Rachel.
Robert Burns, obviously.
Yes, we have a literary witch right there. Here we go. Burns, yes. And it was about witches dancing, which probably just meant women having a dance. But that, in the political and religious times of that era, that meant that you were in league with the devil and you were doing bad things. Suspicious, indeed.
It's often thought that most of the accused were healers and midwives. That was sometimes the case. But actually, people could be accused for all sorts of reasons. For dancing, for simply looking or behaving differently, or for doing things that other people, usually men in positions of power, didn't like.
Gellis Duncan, anybody heard of her? Gilly Duncan from Outlander?
This time, it was Charlie with her hand up.
Outlander was my pandemic indulgence, don't judge me.
Yes, there we go. An Outlander face, that is. Yes. Now, she was a real woman. She worked as a maidservant for a man called David Seaton out in East Lothian. But she was also a very gifted healer, and she would do a hard day's work, and then every other night or so, she'd sneak out of her master's house at night, and she'd go off and help people who were sick or needy. When David Seaton found this out, he accused her of being a witch, which she denied, but that made no difference at all.
Once accused, suspected witches would have a confession forced out of them.
Now, we've always been very, very creative in Edinburgh, and certainly we didn't hold back on creative torture. So has anybody heard of the pillywhack? The pillywhack is a metal device that goes over your two thumbs. She's tightened and tightened and tightened until the bones burst under the pressure. Now, if you didn't confess with the pillywhack, you might be winched, which is a rope around your neck, then bound around your head and tightened until the facial bones are crushed. This happened to Gellis, but she wouldn't confess, so they threw her into the prison. In prison, she was starved of food, water and sleep. And then, because she still wouldn't confess, they brought in the witch pricker. At the time, they believed that if you were a witch, you'd made a deal with the devil and he'd visited you and licked you and left a mark on your skin. This mark, which could be a mole or a blemish or even a freckle, would be pricked with a pin or a needle or a knife about this length. And if they found one that didn't bleed and didn't make you scream in pain, that was proof that you were a witch.
A mark was supposedly found on Gellis's neck, and her fate was sealed.
Now, I bet you're going to wish you had brought your brooms, because we're going all the way up to the castle now, so follow me, my darlings. Take your time.
After getting some of the gorier details about the Scottish witch hunts from Juniper, we brave the winds of hilltop Edinburgh to meet history professor Julian Goodair.
Hello.
From the University of Edinburgh.
Nice to meet you.
This is Rachel.
Oh, pleased to meet you.
Lovely to meet you.
Yes, so welcome to Edinburgh, yes.
We want to know where this deranged concept of witch hunting came from in the first place, and how it spread so ferociously.
We're just below Edinburgh Castle, which is perched on its rock. It was known as a castle hill, and it's the open area where many witches were burnt.
Julian's written three books on the witch trials that gripped early modern Europe. He's also created a database mapping out historical witch accusations and murders across Scotland. And he tells us why this exact spot at the foot of the castle, high up on a rock in the centre of the city, was the perfect location for burning the strangled bodies of accused witches.
You know, the smoke from the pyre will be visible for miles. It will send a very definite signal. You should be tied to a stake and strangled and burnt for an example and terror to others.
It's such a chilling image. The smoke from burning human flesh rising high above the city for all to see as a kind of warning. Nearly 4,000 people were tried for witchcraft in Scotland alone, and more than half of those were executed. Across Europe, the death toll is thought to have reached at least 50,000.
I think you're just going down the steps and then up again.
Ah, well, there we go. We need the local.
Yeah, we've got a local guide.
We've been going up and down and around.
The wind eventually gets the better of us, so we take shelter in a nearby library, where Julian tells us how the European witch hunts really got going.
Well, the idea of the conspiratorial group of evil witches who are in league with the devil is basically a 15th century idea, and it starts to be invented by a group of writers in the French-speaking Alpine region in the 1420s and 1430s.
Julian explains that something similar to the modern word for witch starts to get used in various languages to describe heretics who are supposedly worshipping the devil. After book printing takes off in Germany from 1440, these ideas spread further and wider. And there's one book that really captures the public's imagination.
The Malleus Maleficarum.
The Malleus Maleficarum, or The Hammer of Witches. This was a book written by a German churchman and inquisitor guy called Heinrich Kramer. It's basically a manual on how to identify, torture, prosecute, and execute supposed witches. Pretty misogynistic and homophobic stuff. So, naturally, it was a hit.
But was it actually?
It actually was, second only to the Bible in book sales for 200 years.
Wow.
At least, that's what the publishers claim in the book blurb.
What, it's still in print?
Yeah, you can literally still buy this book. And if you're as obsessed with the idea of witches having sex with the devil as Heinrich seemed to be, it could be something for you.
Ew.
I know. Of course, the idea of witches, of sorcery and magic, existed in many different forms around the world long before all of this. But the witch Heinrich and his mates were talking about was a different kind of witch, the demonic witch.
The demonic witch, and that's the witch who is in league with the devil, the witch who has made a pact with the devil, who has sold their soul to the devil. And that's a specifically Christian idea.
This specifically Christian idea of the demonic, devil-worshipping witch helps set the stage for the widespread witch trials of the next two centuries. Julian explains that there were only a few places in Europe that didn't get swept up in this murderous trend, like the Balkans, which at the time was part of the Muslim Ottoman Empire. Elsewhere on the continent, the Protestant Reformation added a new sense of urgency to the panic around witchcraft.
Half of Europe became Protestant. Only half. The other half remain Catholic. Each side hates the other side. Each side is convinced that they're good and the other lot are wicked. But because they're good and the other lot are wicked, they have to prove that they're good.
Nations and rulers were desperate to prove their devotion to God. And one way to do this was to go on a crusade against the devil and against witchcraft. And although you'll often hear terms like witch panic or witch hysteria, witch hunting was actually something highly organised and systematic. Witchcraft was a crime enshrined in law across Europe and prosecuted through the courts.
So it's really not just villagers waving pitchforks.
Not at all. And one of the rulers who really latched onto this whole witch hunting hype as a means of maintaining power was one young King James VI, son of Mary, Queen of Scots. And someone who got caught up in his crusade was Gilles Duncan, the woman whose torture Juniper described earlier.
Finally, Gellis confessed that she was one of the North Berwick witches. She agreed to their suggestions that there were over 200 of them and that they had cursed King James's ships on the beach at Halloween, speaking rhymes and riddles into the sea before dancing up the hill to the church and cavorting with the devil himself.
The North Berwick witches. Looks like we're heading east.
Ah, little ken thy reverent granny, that sack she coughed for her wee nanny, with £2 Scots, 'twas all her riches, would ever have graced a dance of witches.
Ooh, cold. So we've arrived in North Berwick?
Yes. The bustling North Berwick.
Quaint and charming it is. Bustling it is not. North Berwick is half an hour on the train east of Edinburgh. It's a super cute seaside town with squat stone houses and cobblestone streets, sat atop the rough, rocky coastline of East Lothian. Cute with a side of brutal history. Because this is also where one of Scotland's most infamous deadly witch trials played out. The very one that saw Gilles Duncan and up to 200 others burned at the stake. So given how important this place is in the history of the witch trials, surely this is where we'll see how Scotland is reckoning with its dark past and why. So we set off looking for signs. Quite literally.
Off we go. Town centre beach, straight ahead.
No, but he did say turn right.
But very quickly, we get sidetracked.
Rachel has found Sugar Mountain, which is this adorable fairy tale looking chocolate and sweets shop. Oh, I'm so excited. Okay, I'm going to get some Edinburgh Rock, some tablet, and
some macaroon boats.
But don't worry, it does lead us to a clue.
I'll leave you one open. How about that?
Perfect, thank you. Do you get a lot of people here coming to do, like, witch trial tourism?
Witch trials?
Yeah.
Do you know about witches, like?
We're actually here to do a podcast about witches.
Witches? There's probably poor women who were accused of being witches in the cemetery because back in the day they were just anybody. You know what I mean? You had the wrong colour of eyes. They would just, like, burn them.
Yeah.
Have you got a wee bag that can...
I'll pop it in here, yeah.
Yes. Thank you so much. Okay. Thanks, bye.
Taking the sweet shop lady's advice, we decide to check out the cemetery round the corner.
So we're approaching an open cemetery.
But sadly, there's no mention of witches in sight at all. Just mossy headstones and the crumbly old ruins of a long abandoned church.
Excuse me. We're looking for the site of the original North Berwick witch trials.
Right. Okay. It's either this or by the harbour. There's an old thing. So if you head sort of down...
Onwards, yeah. We go.
Looking for a little chapel, some ruins, where the witches used to congregate.
There we go.
St. Andrew's Old Kirk. Oh, here are the ruins.
This patch of grass with some old stones is, in fact, the place we've been looking for. It's the site of the old chapel, where 200 witches supposedly once gathered to dance and conspire with the devil himself. There's supposed to be some mention of it here, but we can't see anything.
We're not having much luck. But remember that story about King James and his cursed ships on Halloween? That scene played out right here, just around the corner.
We've made it to the sea. We gaze out over the turbulent Firth of Forth. This is the very harbour where King James was supposed to bring his new bride ashore, Princess Anne of Denmark. But when severe storms out at sea thwarted the crossing several times, James concluded that it must be the work of witches out to get him. It may sound nuts, but this is what triggered one of Scotland's earliest and most notorious witch trials. And yet, there's nothing here to commemorate it.
But then, we get a tip from an unlikely place. The Seabird Centre.
Hiya, a quick question. We were actually looking for information about the witch trials. Is there anywhere where we would see something about that? I know it's not a seabird question, sorry.
I think the only thing I've ever really seen out and about is further up the road. So you see the white lifeboat building there?
Oh, yeah.
If you take the road straight up there.
Yeah.
Didn't he say it was between...
Oh my God, yeah, literally by the toilets. Okay, so it says... In the 1590s, several local people were accused of causing a storm which delayed a ship carrying King James VI and his bride from Denmark. And there's, quite a creepy picture.
Yeah, it's a bunch of deranged-looking witches... Mostly women. Long hair, pointy noses, breasts visible. And they're wearing skirts,
oh, no,
they're kicking
a
up
devil
their
in
heels.
The with massive wings and horns. They've all got bare feet and they're dancing around candles and they look so out of it.
They look possessed.
Yeah. I find it just a bit disrespectful that, you know, the witches haven't got anything apart from an old sign with seagull poo on it right next to the public toilets. So I don't know, maybe they don't want people to know that much about it.
No nation really wants to look at the bad things that happened in the past, do they?
We've travelled a little further north to Dundee to meet author Zoe Vendatozzi.
And Scotland really, really likes to see itself as this progressive, sort of semi-Nordic country where we invented loads of stuff and we travelled around the world being amazing. But we know that Scotland was involved in lots of terrible things. You know, we were really involved in colonisation of different countries. We were really involved in the transatlantic slave trade. We made a lot of money off that.
Thinking about it, Scotland has often hit the headlines in recent years for positive, progressive stuff. especially when it comes to women's rights. They have a relatively high proportion of women in Parliament, at nearly 50%. And in 2021, they famously scrapped the so-called tampon tax, where period products are taxed as luxury items. So if the country's got a pretty good track record today, why keep raking over the past?
We need to know about the difficult things that happened in history so that we're a better nation, so we're better people.
Talking about these difficult things is one of the main reasons that Zoe launched the Witches of Scotland campaign, together with barrister Claire Mitchell. They want justice for the accused witches, public awareness, proper memorial sites, and official acknowledgement. Yep, it was pressure from their campaign which led to that recent apology in the Scottish Parliament.
Before this Parliament right now is a petition demanding a pardon for the more than 4,000 people in Scotland, the vast majority of them women, accused and in many cases convicted and executed for being witches under the Witchcraft Act of 1563. Those who met this fate were not witches, they were people. It was injustice on a colossal scale, driven at least in part by misogyny in its most literal sense, hatred of women.
In this speech, then Scottish Premier Nicola Sturgeon drew a direct connection between that past violent injustice and the struggles of women today, from everyday sexism to financial inequality, or even physical danger.
Of course, the lives of women are still blighted each and every day by an epidemic of harassment, abuse, threats and violence. An epidemic that seems to be getting worse, not better. That problem is real and it is very current. But the misogyny that motivates it is age old.
And what about the age-old misogyny hidden in our language? We haven't even stopped using the word witch. Like Zoe points out, even if it's not meant literally, it's still such a loaded insult.
Witch is so handy because witch sounds very like the word bitch, but it's not actually swearing, so you can get away with saying it, and it doesn't seem as harsh as if I was to say, oh, she's a bitch. But you can say witch, and then it's also kind of ha-ha, that's funny too, and the picture people have in their head of, like, you know, kind of the warty nose and the pointy fingers and, you know, eating children and all that kind of thing. It's just a really quick shorthand to diminish women, isn't it? It works.
This kind of caricature of the witch is deeply ingrained in pop culture. Take the Wicked Witch of the West or the Slavic Baba Yaga. They're both frightening, evil old women.
I'll get you, my pretty, and your little dog too.
On the other hand, the words we use for men with magical powers, like wizard or warlock, they don't tend to carry the same stigma.
Yeah, imagine hearing about a wizard hunt. That would just sound like a cool game, don't you think?
Exactly. But then again, there is a good witch in The Wizard of Oz too.
True.
And actually, when I think about it, many of the witches that I met in books or on screen growing up, they were characters that I kind of idolised, or at the very least I wanted to be friends with them.
Like Sabrina Spellman, Hermione Granger, the Charmed witches.
Mm-hmm, yes. These characters are all kind of relatable, but they're gifted with magical powers. It's pretty easy to see why that appeals to little girls.
We're told from birth, you can't look after yourself, you're likely to get murdered, you can't go out at night. If you do go out at night, make sure you can run, don't wear this, but wear that. Be with boys, be with men. You know, we're told you're powerless from the get-go. So I think it's natural that we would try and find a magical power within ourselves, and enough time had elapsed between the witch trials and modern culture to be able to say, right, well, you know, I could be like Sabrina.
We'll be back in just a moment.
Hi, I'm Phelan Johnson.
And I'm Leah Simone Bowen, and we look at history a bit differently. Have you ever wondered how hundreds of wild horses came to inhabit an island in the Atlantic Ocean?
Or what Lord of the Rings and a small town in Manitoba have in common? Or the burning question, did Canada invent the teen drama?
The Secret Life of Canada is a podcast about the country you know and the stories you don't. New episodes available now wherever you get your podcasts.
what happens if you want to believe that sending money to a psychic will change the course of your destiny? Are you a victim or a willing participant in your own deceit?
If somebody says the right words, anybody can become a victim.
From ITN Productions and Sony Music Entertainment, The Greatest Scam Ever Written is coming August 1st. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts to binge all episodes or listen weekly wherever you get your podcasts.
And we're back. Where were we? So the image of the witch has morphed over time. Of course, nowadays, plenty of people proudly identify as witches. So it means different things to different people. But what about the witch hunt?
This trial is a total witch hunt.
The entire thing has been a witch hunt.
It's a witch hunt. That's all it is.
A witch hunt, as I call it.
It's a witch hunt. It's just a continuation of a witch hunt. They want to silence you.
You're talking about the witch hunt? Is that what you mean?
Russian witch hunt.
As a continuation of the greatest witch hunt of all time.
It's a witch hunt in the truest sense of the word.
You know, I call it a witch hunt. And it is a witch hunt.
Hundreds of years on from the European and Salem trials, witch hunt has become a common catchphrase for powerful people who think they're being treated unfairly. Most of them male, many of them politicians. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, ex-South African President Jacob Zuma, and many former US presidents like Bill Clinton and Richard Nixon. Although none quite so loud as Donald Trump, who between 2017 and 2021 tweeted the words witch hunt 379 times, basically once or twice a week.
There's no victim except me. I'm the victim here. There's no victim. There's no victim whatsoever. This is just a witch hunt.
In Trump's case, he's currently involved in a litany of legal battles, all of which he sees as unjust. And in July 2024, there was also an attempt on his life. But he still doesn't seem to have much in common with people targeted in the original witch hunts.
And he really has the profile of a witch hunter, doesn't he? You know, he's male, he's powerful, he's a central figure in government. He aligns himself with certain aspects of the Christian right. These are all positions that you imagine a witch hunter to occupy. But he does repeat his claim that he is, in fact, the victim of a witch hunt.
The tables have turned. That's Marion Gibson, by the way. She has the seriously cool job title of Professor of Renaissance and Magical Literatures at the University of Exeter in the UK. Her book, Witch Hunt, A History in 13 Trials, maps witch hunting all the way from the Middle Ages up to this modern twist on the term. And she explains that it's been used all along the political spectrum.
You know, it's used as far back as the 1950s. People might have come across the idea of the communist or anti-communist, rather, witch hunts of the 1950s in America just keeps coming back again. So Arthur Miller wrote the play The Crucible, for example, about the idea that the communists were being, quote, witch hunted in America. So he thought, well, why don't I dramatize this by using the Salem witchcraft trials, an actual witchcraft trial, as a metaphor for anti-communist hunting in the 50s. So ever since then, I think Americans have been kind of primed to use the idea of the witch hunt in political contexts.
And now people at the very top of politics, it seems like they're kind of weaponizing this very real historical term, right?
Yeah. And, you know, it kind of ties into the confusing cancel culture narrative that we have today, where powerful people, celebrities or politicians, they're called out for things like racism or transphobia or even breaking the law. And when they're faced with consequences, they say they feel like they're victims of a mob, victims of a hunt.
It's kind of ironic. When I hear the word mob, the first thing that comes to mind for me is images of Trump supporters storming the US Capitol.
Right? And this whole thing is even more jarring when you consider one vital part of the story that we haven't even got to yet.
All around the world, people are still on trial for witchcraft, you know, whether that's in Indonesia or Nepal or Southern Africa. Hundreds and hundreds of people are on trial for witchcraft, and many of those are murdered.
Okay, perfect. We're recording on your phone. We're recording here. Hi, Leo. How are you?
Yeah, I'm great. And you?
Yeah, good. Good, yeah.
My name is Leo Igwe. I'm from Mbise in southeastern Nigeria.
Leo Igwe is the founder and director of the Advocacy for Alleged Witches, a human rights organisation he started in 2020. In the past several decades in Africa, tens of thousands of people are estimated to have been murdered for suspected witchcraft. Children are often targets, as well as people who aren't seen as fitting in, but mostly it's single elderly women. So-called witch refugee camps have sprung up in northern Ghana and in South Africa, where women branded as witches live in exile.
It is still not known the scale of witch hunting in the region. The reason is that, first of all, it happens in rural areas. And when it happens in these areas, the perpetrators are the powerful ones, socially or culturally powerful ones. There are no repercussions. Many of the witch hunting incidents, go unreported. That's number one. Number two, the victims are usually the poor. There are people in very weak financial, socio-cultural positions. So they will not be able to take any action either in terms of reporting.
The belief in evil spirits and the concept of magic, for good and for bad, has likely existed in pretty much all human societies since forever. But before colonization and before the spread of certain branches of Christianity, there weren't anti-witchcraft movements in Africa. And it was rare that suspected witches were killed.
Before Europeans came, Africans were also living their lives and making sense of their fortune and misfortune using the supernatural. Now, they now introduced their own religion, which they made Africans to understand that that was a better religion. Now, within the religion, there is also a witchcraft narrative. So, Christianity reinforced the witchcraft belief.
Leo says that the modern-day belief in demonic witchcraft in Africa is often explained away, like it's just part of tradition, superstition, or a backwards belief system. But actually, it has a lot to do with things like the spread of disease and profound economic hardship, which is tearing communities apart.
In the absence of social welfare, in the absence of state support, in the absence of good economy, a lot of people spiritualize their problem. And on the basis of this spiritualization, they take actions against neighbors, innocent people. In 2019, a parent poisoned the children because a pastor said in a church that the problem in their families were caused by the children. So the parent poisoned the children, three of them.
This atmosphere of hardship and resentment is causing a deep rift between generations. And Leo tells me that some young people in Africa, lacking jobs and opportunities, are despairing over their future. Looking for someone to blame, they might latch on to the witchcraft conspiracy.
They spiritualize it and sometimes make these elderly ones scapegoats. Sometimes they kill them in the night, sometimes they kill them secretly, sometimes they kill them and bury them without anybody getting to know. People are being killed. People are being, buried alive. People are being poisoned.
It's not just happening in Africa, though. And it's not just happening at a community level. In 2022, a state in Malaysia officially outlawed shamanism and witchcraft. In 2009, the Saudi Arabian government created a special anti-witchcraft unit to investigate people suspected of sorcery. Many of those targeted appear to be foreign workers. And as recently as 2014, a man was beheaded there for allegedly practicing black magic.
These are real victims of real witch hunts. And they do have a lot in common with those original victims from hundreds of years ago. Vulnerable outsiders, people struggling to explain extreme hardship and misfortune, and falling victim to conspiracies. Here's Marion again.
The Middle Ages in Europe was not a happy time. Not only was there religious conflict, but there was also famine, there was plague. And it's also been described as an era when the Little Ice Age, as it's sometimes called, is kicking off. So the climate is more unpredictable. Things are more difficult for people. There are more crop failures and more extreme weather. And those are the kind of things that tend to get blamed on witches.
Conflict, pandemics, extreme weather. Sound familiar?
This is by no means saying, oh, these places are backward. They are doing the same things as Europeans were doing in the Middle Ages. It's something far more complicated than that. But I do think there are similarities. It's about the social conditions in which these things happen. And if they are the same, it kind of doesn't matter which century you're in. You might end up going down the same path. The idea of the witch has changed a lot over time, but people are still being prosecuted as witches around the world. And we're still using the word witch, even though we're not always sure what it means.
Language is important. And there's no denying that the language of the witch hunts is rooted in a very dark, very violent history. Whether it's in Scotland or Nigeria or the United States, parts of that history are still so relevant. So I guess what we're saying is this history matters.
And if you don't look back at the roots of the witch trial, which are in the Middle Ages in Europe, then you really don't understand where this is all coming from. For me, this is a long history of persecution. And if you don't understand how persecution begins, then it's very difficult to understand why it's still carrying on today.
This episode was written by Charlie Shield and me, Rachel Stewart. It was produced by Charlie Shield. It was edited by Sam Baker, who's named after a witch herself, fact-checked by Katarina Abel, and scrutinised by our token man, Chris Cowler. Thank you so much for listening. If you like us, leave us a rating and a review so that other fans of Curious Histories can find us. We'll be back in 2 weeks.
Dear Kaliach, Ancient One, heed our call tonight. Unveil our fortunes and guide us through with your wisdom and your might. As day turns into night and light fades into shadow's art, bestow on these new witches your whisper, a magical chart. Now we just listen.